is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Around the world, more than 565,000 people have died from COVID-19, and there are over 12.7 million confirmed cases. Surging confirmed cases have made South Africa the ninth most affected country by the disease, according to Johns Hopkins University. South Africa has over 264,000 cases, including more than 3,900 deaths, and accounting for more than 40% of all the reported cases in Africa. More than 30% of South Africa's cases are in the economic hub of Gauteng province, which includes the largest city, Johannesburg, and the capital, Pretoria. The densely populated Soweto Township is also a hotspot. Africa's 54 countries have reported nearly 578,000 cases. That's according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reporting on Sunday. But the number of cases could be much higher as testing rates are low. The continent's confirmed cases are concentrated in four countries: South Africa, Egypt, Nigeria, and Algeria. India's coronavirus caseload is nearing 850,000, with a record surge of over 28,600 in the past 24 hours, prompting authorities to announce a week-long lockdown in the key southern technology hub of Bangalore, home to Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon. The new confirmed cases took the national total to over 849,500, the health ministry reported Sunday, with more than 22,600 deaths. India has overtaken Russia in the number of cases and is currently behind the United States and Brazil. Meantime, the governor of Okinawa Island is demanding a top U.S. military commander take tougher prevention measures after 60 Marines died at two bases in the past 2 days. This is VOA News. Polish voters went to the polls on Sunday in a tight presidential runoff between a populist incumbent allied with U.S. President Donald Trump and a Euro-focused liberal aligned with Brussels. The stakes are high for Poland's right-wing Law and Justice Party government, which has relied on incumbent President Andrzej Duda to push through judicial reforms that have set Warsaw on a collision course with the EU over democratic standards. And this just three decades after communism ended in Poland. Poland's president is locked in a tight race with the mayor of Warsaw of the opposition Civic Platform. Final opinion polls showed an almost even split between the two. Election had been due in May at a time when Duda was leading, but it was delayed because of the pandemic. The president's support has slipped considerably since then, partly because of the virus, which is pushing Poland into its first recession since communism fell. Mali President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita has announced the dissolution of the Constitutional Court in an attempt to calm unrest that saw four people killed in street protests Friday. The president said he would not tolerate such violence. The court has been at the center of controversy after it overturned provisional results for parliamentary elections in March. There are growing calls for President Keita to resign. Opponents are unhappy with his handling of Mali's long-running jihadist conflict, an economic crisis, and the disputed elections. A new opposition coalition led by the conservative Imam Mahmoud Diku has been insisting on further reforms after rejecting earlier concessions from the Malian president, including the formation of a unity government. Iran claims human error was responsible for the downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane earlier this year that killed all 176 people on board. Excuse me. The Iranian Civil Aviation Authority said this week a failure occurred due to a human error in following the procedure for aligning the radar, and that the misalignment caused a 107 degree error in the system. The downing of the aircraft happened while Iran's defense system was on high alert after one of the country's top generals was killed in a U.S. missile attack in Iraq. And residents of Seoul paid their respects to the South Korean capital's late mayor, Park Won-soon, at a public memorial set up in his honor. The 64-year-old was found dead on a wooded hill in northern Seoul on Friday. He was the mayor of Seoul since 2011. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
In the streets of Bamako, the historic protest against his regime, I think you'll come to understand the gravity of the situation and follow the recommendation made with a good faith, not just to gain some time, not just to fool the people, but for the sake of advancing our country.
A Malian opposition member says President Keita's refusal to implement recommendations from regional leaders is fueling the protests.
Government must also be able to ensure that the students who have gotten to the last stage of their academic discipline, as far as college is concerned, that they're able to write their exams and conclude without their process. And that is not asking for too much.
A former Nigerian vice president disagrees with a government decision to prevent students from taking their final year examination over coronavirus concerns.
Talking about not only freedom of expression, not only as right, but of for civil society to operate, for civil society to make demands, for civil society to hold government accountable, for civil society to demand for justice.
And West Africa civil society groups call on the Gambian president to create an enabling environment for civil society groups to freely operate. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mali, a member of the opposition coalition M5RFP says President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is to blame for tensions in the country. Yesa Maki, a former presidential and parliamentary candidate, says the president's failure to implement recommendations from regional leaders led to the protest. His comments come after the president announced his commitment to dialogue with opposition leaders in a national address Saturday. He also plans to implement recommendations by regional leaders. Yesa Maki says the president dithered instead of implementing the recommendations of the regional leaders. He tells me the president failed to implement proposed solutions to help resolve the challenges the country faces. The result, he says, has been the loss of human life and the country's potential slide into chaos.
Dialogue is a virtue, especially in the Malian context. And Ibeka has been given plenty of opportunity to speak, especially to listen to the people of Mali. And when this situation started, a mission from CDAO came to Mali, spoke with the main stakeholders, including the president himself and the opposition groups. At the conclusion of the mission, they gave a recommendation. Among those recommendations were dissolution or the dissolving of the national parliament, which Ibeka has the constitutional right and attribution to this. They also suggested that one of the root causes of this protest is the unfair election for parliament, and where the results of the elections are contested, they recommended that Ibeka organize partial elections in those areas. And also they recommended that he form a national unity government. All of these recommendations were left unanswered. Ibeka didn't give any sense that he approves of this recommendation or he is willing to implement any of these recommendations. The opposition groups demanding his resignation also spoke with him and addressed a number of recommendations to resolve the crisis.
Let me ask you, Mr. Samaki, does that mean that his call for dialogue has been overtaken by events? For which reason opposition leaders are demanding his resignation?
No, he has come to dialogue empty-handed without any solution to discontent of the majority of the Malian people, including the unfair election of members of parliament in certain jurisdictions, including the district of Kati, Sikasso, and Kominsenk in Bamako. He didn't come with any solution. He comes always with promise of other meetings, which confirm the position of most Malians today that Ibeka is not in control, that there is a shadow government that has taken our country into hostage, that Ibeka himself, out of age and sickness is no longer in decision-making capacity.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Samaki. Does that mean that there is no solution in sight? Or what do you think the solution is currently to resolve this tension? Because the protesters have vowed to continue to protest until he steps down.
And they should until there is a proper response from the president. As indicated at the beginning of this dialogue, I told you that the commission of the CDAO that has come to Mali after listening to all parties have made some recommendations. And it is only tonight, after loss of lives, after clash between police force and civilians, and after his regime has killed a number of young Malians already, it's only tonight that he's come with a proposition or a solution trying to implement the recommendations that were offered to him 2 weeks ago, namely the 20th of June. And today we are the 10th, even the 11th today of July. Why wait if you are ending up taking the same decision that were proposed to you a few weeks ago? So we don't understand what his thinking is. And this has been a pattern in Ibeka's decision. He has to be forced to make any decision. When he voted a law for the teachers, which Article 39 was a blocking point, it took state protest for him to be able to declare that he's willing to implement that law.
So let me ask you this. Do you foresee the president striking a deal with the opposition leaders to ease this tension and to maintain the status quo, or that he will be forced to step down or take measures to dissolve parliament and implement the decisions that were made to him by regional leaders?
Some of those decisions made to him by regional leaders, today he was forced another appearance on TV where he declared that he has dissolved the constitutional court and that he is open to a unity government. And but he waited till things got out of hand, where there were loss of human life, to finally come to the understanding that this is not the demand of one man. This is the demand of a frustrated people of Mali. We the people. He should have heard our voices a long time ago. He has time and time again come back on decisions he's already made, including laws that he's voted. But we hope that in the light of the loss of lives, in the light of the number of people, the overwhelming masses in the street of Bamako, the historic protest against his regime, I think he'll come to understand the gravity of the situation and follow the recommendation made, but with a good faith, not just to gain some time, not just to fool the people, but for the sake of advancing our country.
Yes, Samake is a leading member of the Malian opposition coalition M5RFP. He spoke with me from Yellowstone, Montana. Atiku Abubakar, a former Nigerian vice president, says he sharply disagrees with a government decision which will prevent students from taking the West African Senior School Certificate examinations. Announcing the decision to withdraw students from the examination, Nigerian Education Minister Chukwuemeka Nwajiubwa says public schools will not participate in the West African Senior School Certificate examinations this year. The former vice president, however, disagrees with the decision to prevent students from taking the exams. He contends that the decision would have a negative impact on the students and parents, as well as the country's educational system. Paul Ibe is a spokesperson for the former Nigerian vice president. He tells me that the government should have done better by implementing measures to ensure the students take their final exam while being protected from the coronavirus.
The decision of the federal government was not well thought through, because it did not take into consideration the fact that presently our youth, the Nigerian youth, and our education is playing catch-up. In terms of the indices are not favorable for us. We have, I mean, compared to other African nations and West African nations that also take the same, you know, exams, we have a higher rate of out-of-school children. We have a lower rate of passes, you know, in the school. So this thing should have been taken into consideration, because even as desirable as it is to protect the children, the young people who will be taking these exams because of the pandemic, but we also need to balance that with the compelling need to ensure that the education of these young people does not suffer the consequences.
Well, I understand where where you're coming from. However, some people are saying that the government came under criticism for not acting proactively enough to address this issue of the spread of the coronavirus. However, they congratulated the president for taking such a bold decision to limit the spread of the virus among school children who will be taking examinations. So what do you make of this congratulation of this coming from supporters of the administration as well as some critics?
Well, it is desirable, like I said, it is desirable to contain the spread of the pandemic. But I mean, elsewhere in other countries, including the United States of America, there is a deliberate and smart ways of trying to ensure that schools are open, children go back to school. But even in this particular case, it's not about opening the whole school. It's about ensuring that those who are qualified, who have applied to take the exams, the West African Examination Council exams, take that exam. I mean, that's what it's all about. And it's not about opening the whole school. So government can and has it to be able to mobilize all of the infrastructures that are available to ensure that social distancing is observed, even as these children, young people, write their exams. So that can be done. There are so many available infrastructure, including our primary schools. Just mobilize all of that and make it possible for the young people to write the exams without compromising their health.
Paul, some people have said what you have enumerated so far, the government seems to have been doing that. So how or what more can the government do, pragmatically speaking, to limit the spread of the disease, particularly when cases of infection keep rising in Nigeria?
Well, we acknowledge the fact that we need to continue to do the very common sense approach to wash hands and all of that, continue to avoid crowded places, which is being done, to wear masks and observe social distancing, and of course from the science perspective to do contact tracing and all of that. Sure, but the truth of the matter is that even as you're doing all of this, there must be also be looking at how to open up things, how to move forward. We can't be in lockdown in perpetuity. It's not just possible, because what will happen is that at the end of the day, we will have lost so much ground, considering that already we are disadvantaged much. How many people are going to be writing this exam? What will be needed to ensure that these children write the exam in an environment that is conducive enough to social distancing and all of that?
So, Paul, let me ask you, what is the position of the former vice president in terms of how this government has dealt with the issue of limiting the spread of the coronavirus in Nigeria so far?
First incident case was of an Italian and all of that. So he had encouraged them, he had ordered them to close the airspace, minimize the number of people who are coming in that would bring the disease. Of course, that did not happen. It began to spread, and having that happened, it was also pertinent. He had also advocated the need to have some limited lockdown, and so that you restrict movement to be able to ensure that even if there are people who have the disease, they'll be contained within a certain geographical space, and then it can be easier to deal with. So, I mean, he has supported all of those measures that were taken. But of course, his grounds, like I said, was that it did not start earlier than, it has started earlier. Of course, what would have happened is that they would not have had, large number of people who had imported, the disease, into Nigeria. So he has he supports the measures that have been adopted, like I said, the common sense washing of hands, using a mask, having a social distancing, and avoiding crowded places. So he is in full with all of those measures that have been adopted. However, he says that for the purposes of education, being a very important aspect of all of the things that we are inspired to be as a nation and as the people, government must also be able to ensure that the students who have gotten to the last stage of their academic as far as college is concerned, that they're able to write their exams and conclude with that process. And that is not asking for too much.
Paul Ibe is a spokesperson for former Nigerian Vice President Atiku Abubakar. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The West Africa Civil Society Institute and partners have called on the Gambian President Adama Barrow to create an enabling environment for civil society groups to freely operate without a hindrance. In a petition to the Gambian leader, the groups also called for independent and thorough inquiries into the shooting death of Haruna Jatta, allegedly by ECOMIC forces in 2017. His arbitrary arrest and torture led to the death of Usman Dabo, allegedly by the anti-crime unit in 2019, and an expedited trial of police officers accused of stabbing Kibba Seka to death. The remarks come after the administration in Banjul came under sharp criticism following the arrest of Madi Jobate, a prominent human rights activist. Omolara Balogun is the head of the Policy Influencing and Advocacy Unit of the West Africa Civil Society Institute. She tells me the government must ensure the right of free speech as guaranteed by the Gambian constitution.
Well, the objective of the letter is very clear. We found the continued harassment of Madi to be quite worrisome, considering the fact that the constitution of the Gambia, the African Union Charter, and the ECOWAS Protocol for Good Governance and Democracy make it quite clear for citizens in the region to have freedom of expression in addition to our human rights. And this is what Madi was doing. So the objective of our letter is very clear. One is for the president to drop all charges against Madi. And I'm pleased to inform you, just a few seconds ago actually to this call, the charges leveled against Madi have just been dropped. And we are excited that in addition to the work that our colleagues have been doing in the Gambia, and the letter that we sent out early this morning has been effective to this regard.
So let me ask you this. The letter also suggests that the government should ensure the protection of free speech as guaranteed by the Constitution. Some are suggesting in the Gambia that if this could be done to a prominent human rights activist, that means every other Gambian could be affected, even if not now, in the near future. What do you say to that?
Well, I think this is correct. As we all know, Madi is a renowned human rights activist and civil society actor in the Gambia. Not only in the Gambia, I'm not a Gambian, but Madi is someone I've worked with for over 12 years across West Africa region. So it's really disturbing if a person of Madi caliber can be harassed this way. Then what is the fate of younger comrades and civil society activists and human rights defenders in the Gambia? And this is a trend that we are seeing across West Africa, where our people are not only being harassed, but their voices are being stifled by the different powers that be. So this is disturbing, and it's something that should be moved almost immediately. And this is why we shall, it's important that all of us across the region, across the continent, stand up against this unwelcoming behavior of our government and act in solidarity like we have just done today.
Ms. Balogun, there are some who are suggesting that irrespective of the charges that have been dropped against Madi, that those who break the law should be made to face the full force of the law, and that some Gambians want to get away with it just because they are human rights defenders, because they are popular, and that they think that they are immune or they have protection because of their status in society. How do you respond to that?
I think and I believe across the globe, within every society, nobody is above the law. Not even the president of any country is above the law of the country. So we are people have clearly violated the law of the land. Definitely, we are not of the opinion that those people should be protected. But within the same ambit of the law, where people have not done anything contradictory to the law of the land, it is against the law for them to be harassed or arrested arbitrarily, like we are seeing across the region. The law is clear. We haven't violated any law whatsoever. I shouldn't be harassed. I should be given the freedom to express myself, to express my rights. But if I am found to have violated any law proven, then that's another ballgame entirely. But the case that we're talking about now, it's very clear that Madi has not violated any law. You can see the way that the cases have been dropped against him. It has no space within the ambit of the law that somebody made an expression with fact and evidence. I mean, if you know the facts, they are there.
Ms. Balogun, let me ask you, in the letter that you wrote jointly with other organizations, one of what you are immediately demanding is for the government to create an enabling environment for civil society organizations to operate by removing restrictions on the right to freedom of expression to ensure that civil society activists and citizens can express themselves without fear of reprisal. What specifically do you want to see? What measures do you want to see implemented to create this environment?
We are seeing a replay of continuous human rights violations like we did experience under different military rule 2 decades ago. For example, the Gambian democracy that we have now, we call it the Gambia Project. We all stood up to reject and remove the dictator that used to be there. So it's going to be a shame if we see our Gambia as a state going down this road. So we are talking about not only freedom of expression, not only of rights, but of faith, for civil society to operate, for civil society to make demands, for civil society to hold government accountable, for civil society to demand for justice, to demand for protection of human rights. We are asking for a space that gives civil society that, you know, that pride and freedom to express themselves.
Omolara Balogun is the head of the Policy Influencing and Advocacy Unit of the West Africa Civil Society Institute. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Justice Minister Celestin Tunda has resigned from President Felix Tshisekedi's government Saturday. His resignation followed sharp policy differences with the president over proposed laws that would enable politicians to have control over the prosecution of criminal cases. The resignation comes after reports the Justice Minister presented his letter of recommendation regarding judicial reforms to Parliament without consulting the government. Supporters of the Justice Minister deny the allegation. Herbert Kabasu Babu Katolondi is an author, a former governor of the Kasai province, and a political analyst. He tells me that the rift between the ruling party coalition will deepen with the resignation, but will unlikely unravel the pact between the political parties.
The relationship between the president and Mr. Tunde Yakasende was very bad. But in this case here, there was no internal procedure whatsoever. But the president wanted Mr. Tunde Yakasende not to get access to the meeting of the government. But I think to avoid any antagonism that can really jeopardize the coalition, I think the leadership of the FCC, which is Tunde Yakasende's coalition, asked him to elegantly resign. But I don't think it will have any consequence, because it will be replaced with somebody who will be capable of being more or less flexible with regard to the demands of the president.
So how are people taking this resignation, looking at the fact that from your analysis, you think there will be no significant impact in his resignation and the dispute with the president? So basically, the president is going to have his way.
In the Congo, the presidency is a different, separate institution from the government. But the president has got this tendency of going beyond his prerogative. However, I think people, the opinions are divided, polarized. The people who are with the UDP as the president's party and its allies, they say today, from the morning, they've been saying that it is a proof, a demonstration of the president's power, because people have been saying the president is a toothless dog. Now, the president has really shown that he's in control, he's in charge, he's got power. He can prompt or activate a minister, a vice, not even a simple minister, but a vice president. Minister resigned. But on the other side, although the people of former President Kabila coalition FCC have been humble, they have not spoken in negatively about it. They tend to say, okay, it is an elegant way out. In reality, they see that the president really is going toward trying to have more power than allocated to him by the Constitution. So it is quite a complex and tricky situation, and nobody can tell exactly what it will lead the Congo to.
What do you see as the relationship between Tunde's political coalition and that of the president.
There are serious contradictions and antagonisms and conflict that are dangerous because they are radically polarizing the Congolese political system and political scene and political society, because you must remember that the president's political party is perceived and is actually tangibly associated with a tribe of the Kasai. And so people tend to see that these activities, the demonstrations with the president's political parties, people going on rampage, vandalizing some properties and so on and so forth, it will lead to a conflict that has really the risk of going into some kind of civil war if the relationship between these two major coalition, president's, first of all, political party, UDPS, and the president's coalition, CAS, versus former President Kabila's FCC. It is urgent for people in society, in the region, internationally, to intervene, really to get these folks to reconcile and consolidate the point of view, because the Congo is now really on a very dangerous slope.
Herbert Kabasu Babu Katolondi is an author, a former governor of the Kasai province, and a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the president of the African Center for Economic Transformation has launched a book entitled Knowing the Beginning Well. The book explores the challenge of Africa's development. Kingsley Yeboah Amoakun, popularly known as KY Amoakun, draws on his 5 decades of experience working for the World Bank and the UN to develop potential answers to Africa's problems. The book explores why Africa's economy is lagging behind other continents despite an abundance of natural resources, a booming youth population, and increasing attractiveness to industry and investors. Speaking with me, KY Amoakun says the book takes an in-depth look at the uneven development of post-colonial Africa and suggests what it will take for the continent to turn things around once and for all.
The book is called Know the Beginning Well, and I try to say that in order to understand plan for the future, it's better to understand the past, what's worked, what didn't work. So on this specific issue of how can we diversify, transform our economies, as I call it, several things need to be done. We need to diversify our production structures. We need to be competitive in the export markets. We need to have productivity across board increases. We need to use more technology. And all this then will lead to better job creation. And that's the lesson that we've learned over the years, not only in Africa, but elsewhere. So those are the factors.
So KY, what will it take to move beyond foreign aid and finance sustainable development? Because as you know, a lot of African countries are on handout to speak with foreign aid, which some people argue that enables other foreign nations to influence these respective governments even when the policies do not go their way.
You're very correct. We've learned a lot. Know the beginning word. Like I said, aid was important. Aid is still important, but aid is not the answer. And in the past, aid has come with conditionality. It has not allowed us to set our own priorities. So going forward, 3 things that we need to do, and I write this all in the book, and my institution, the African Center for Economic Transformation, is working with a number of African countries on these issues. First, we need to increase our own domestic resource, mobilize a lot more of our resources. The second is also we need to use these resources more effectively. Top 4 projects, be transparent in the way we use these resources. Corruption has been a factor. So how we use the limited resources that we've had also becomes important. And third, the private sector. The private sector has to lead in the production of goods and services. So you need to bring in the private sector more actively and give them the incentives and remove loopholes and regulatories. Sort of make them more efficient and more productive in the use of their own resources.
What can we learn from the successes and or failures of groundbreaking initiatives such as the New Partnership for Africa's Development, NEPA, and the African Peer Review Mechanism?
I spent about 2 or 3 chapters in my book address this, because I was there. I was at the Economic Commission for Africa, and I worked with the African leaders, Mbeki, Obasanjo, and all that in driving the agenda. And several things, leadership was important. The leaders of Africa came together and said, this is what we need to do, one. Second, they said African institutions need to lead the charge. So they brought the ECA, they brought the African Development, and we were there, worked with them. Third, they said, okay, we need to get our development partners also to come along in terms of this African-driven initiative. So we went to the G8, we brought them on up. So leadership, institutions, and building capacity, and having an African ownership of the agenda. That's what led to the creation of NEPA, the APRM, and some of the progress made in those days.
Let me ask you this. How did the World Bank's approach to Africa evolve from the days of a colonial era conditional lending to more productive collaborative partnerships?
I spent part of my career 1974 to 1995 at the World Bank. I joined the World Bank as a young professional. I grew up and got promoted to senior level positions before I went to the Economic Commission for Africa. Now, the bank has changed. Conditionality became a big issue under the structure adjustment lending, and that created also challenges and problems, controversies. There was no ownership on what the African governments had to do. The policies were being imposed, and it caused a lot of difficulties. Infrastructure development is so huge. The challenges without good infrastructure, we're talking about the African free trade, continental free trade area, to the leadership of African leaders to come say, hey, folks, we need to do things better. So those are some of the lessons that have been learned here.
Now, you talked about the productive partnership between the public and the private sector, the key ingredient, you say, to successful economic transformation. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this. What are the moral and economic imperatives for closing Africa's gender gap?
I have to be personal here. You're Ghanaian, I'm Ghanaian. My mother never went to school. My mother was illiterate, and I saw the poverty with which she lived in. I have three daughters. On the contrary, all my three daughters are very professionals with education, great universities in the U.S. So you see the difference, giving girls education. When you talk about the moral aspect of gender equality, which I address in Chapter 8 of the book, and here I tend to get a bit more emotional about it because of my own family circumstances, you realize that women today don't have equal access to education. They don't have equal access to land. They don't have equal access to credit. So we need to change our attitudes. And if we do, the economic imperative, the economic impact.
Kingsley Yeboah-Amoakun, popularly known as KY Amoakun, is the president of the African Center for Economic Transformation. He spoke with me from Sterling, Virginia, here in the U.S. Tracking of goods and humanitarian aid from Cameroon to the landlocked Central African Republic has slowed to a trickle, raising tensions between the two sides. Despite an agreement that Cameroon drivers who test negative for COVID-19 will be given access, testing kits are in short supply at the border, forcing some trucks to wait weeks to cross. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Elhaj Umaru, the head of Cameroon's Land Freight Transportation Bureau, says hundreds of trucks at the border town of Garoua-Boulaye have not been given access to the Central African Republic. He says all attempts to convince CAR transport and health officials that the drivers have tested negative for COVID-19 in Cameroon have failed.
Nous avons beaucoup de difficultés de servir le test centrafricain était un parcours de combattant.
Umaru says this week, Cameroon's transport minister assured truck drivers that the CAR will accept COVID-19 test results done in Cameroon hospitals. But Umaru says the COVID-19 test results done in Cameroon are still rejected by CAR border officials. He says he is scandalized that trucks, goods, and humanitarian aid are blocked at the border for several weeks. The CAR and Cameroon sealed their borders in March to stop the spread of the coronavirus after both countries recorded cases of COVID-19. The landlocked CAR entered an agreement with Cameroon to allow passage of humanitarian aid and goods from Cameroon's seaside town of Douala to the CAR capital, Bangui. According to the agreement, only truck drivers who tested negative for COVID-19 were to enter the CAR, but the plan was crippled by a shortage of tests at the border. The drivers, who are mostly Cameroonians, started carrying out the tests in local hospitals. But CAR officials began rejecting the results last month when the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Cameroon increased to more than 13,000. On Monday of this week, delegates from the two countries held a crisis meeting at Garoua Bulaï, and the CAR agreed to recognize COVID-19 test results carried out in Cameroon. But CAR Transport Minister Arno Jubaye Abazeni says the decisions made at the meeting were not final. Abazeni says the mixed commission that the presidents of Cameroon and CAR created to manage land transport will meet to examine threats caused by COVID-19. He says only that the commission can address all the misunderstandings caused at the border as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Abazeni said that once goods and supplies are brought to the border, CAR drivers will transport them to Bangui. He said his country will also consider COVID-19 test results conducted in the CAR in case the border post runs short of rapid diagnostic tests. Cameroon's Minister of Transport, Jean-Ernest Ngalé-Bibéhé, says Cameroon wants a solution to the crisis as soon as possible.
L'autre problème que nous avons rencontré, c'est celui, bien entendu, qui...
He says the coronavirus pandemic preoccupies all governments in the world, and there is no state that will want to joke over COVID-19. He says it is in the interest of Cameroon and the CAR to work together and rescue their collapsing economies. The Central African Republic depends on the Douala seaport for about 95% of its goods and humanitarian aid. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin in Nairobi, where preparations are in high gear for the inaugural World Athletics Continental Tour Gold Series. The Nairobi meet dubbed the Kip Keino Classic, named after Kenyan legend Kipchoge Keino, is slated for September 26. Keino is among the most respected Kenyan athletes of all time. His Olympic gold medals in Mexico 1968 in 1500 meters and Munich 1972 in 3000 steeplechase inspired subsequent domination by Kenyan runners at Olympic Games, World Championships, and other major meets. The Kip Keino Classic will be hosted in Nairobi's freshly refurbished Nyayo National Stadium. Kipchoge Keino is now 80 years old and appreciated the organizers' gesture in naming the meeting after him. Nairobi also hosts the World Athletics Under 20 Championships that were initially set for July 7th to 12th, but which have now been rescheduled to a yet-to-be-confirmed date. Still in athletics, American Noah Lyles briefly appeared to have set a new 200 meters world record of 18.90 seconds in the Inspirational Games before it was revealed he ran only 185 meters. Lyles' time would have obliterated the 19.19 seconds mark set by Jamaican great Usain Bolt back in 2009. Since Lyles' personal best is 19.50 and he was running into a strong headwind, the time was immediately challenged. It was later discovered that world champion Lyles, running on his own in Florida, had started from the wrong lane and ran 15 meters less than his rivals at other tracks. Athletes competed from different venues around the world with starting guns firing simultaneously, and athletes' efforts shown alongside each other on television in a split-screen broadcast. Lales, who won the 200 meters world title in Doha last year, was removed from the race results, and victory in the three-man race handed to Lametra instead. In African football, the Senegalese Football Federation Executive Committee has annulled all its competitions despite earlier hoping to conclude the remaining rounds of matches in November. Also, the committee unanimously decided not to declare champions and not to relegate or promote teams at all levels due to the insufficient ratio of matches played. However, the federation named Tengwet Football Club and Jaref FC as representatives in next season's CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup, respectively, as they were the two best-ranked teams when the season was halted. Tengwet led the standings after 13 rounds of matches with 33 points, 12 ahead of second-placed Jaref. The Senegalese Football Federation has also announced that the new season will start on October 31st. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
halitoshi. Kama ni ya pendo lako, ila upendo wa dhati kwako haunishi. Itunze kama moyo wako. Baby, let me be the only one that you be wanting. Me and you be number one, that's how we they want it. Sir, all these people day when we be start to play. Baby boy born, then they all along to. Baby boy, no shit. Me and you together, baby boy.
Bye.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the lion doesn't turn around when a small dog barks. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.